Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It would appear the question is not if, but when the U.S. will attack Iran. The real question is, why attack at all? Also, Europe is addicted to self-harm. Banning the import of Russian energy is destroying the European economy. Is the political system next? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off here with Mark in Moscow. Obviously, Iran is headlining right now. Will he or won't he is the big question here. Will he attack or will he decide on an exit called Taco? Mark, you know, we all know the history of U.S.-Iranian relations since 1979, which are, they don't exist. But it's been high on the American agenda, obviously, to with Israel in regard. But, you know, why now? I mean, there's a lot of things going on. Why is it so pressing? What is the catalyst? What is the predicate?
Okay, so first of all, on a personal level, it seems that Donald Trump, to an even greater degree than recent U.S. presidents, has a visceral hatred of the Iranian government and society. And he expresses that quite frequently. Secondly, he has already bombed Iran once, right, and they didn't fall into line. And I don't think that he takes very well to that. Third, I would say that according to the Trump administration's new national security strategy and its national defense strategy that was put out last week, the intent of the U.S. is actually to get out of the Middle East, to empower its regional proxies, that being Israel, although it's debatable who is the proxy of whom, I guess you could say. I think there's a degree of syncretism between the two of them. And supposedly Arab countries that are part of the Abraham Accords, although they don't seem that willing, to be perfectly honest to me. But that's what the U.S. wants to leave Middle East hegemony to. However, it's acting in complete contradiction to that. And it seems to have reached the conclusion that, much like with Europe not being able to handle Russia on its own, that Israel is not able to handle Iran on its own anymore either. So I think they've settled on, they want to pivot out of the Middle East, but first they have to clear the board. And all they have to do is just get rid of the largest and most powerful country in the region, which is Iran.
The makings of a quagmire, okay? I will be contrarian, George. I don't think Donald Trump cares about Iran or Iranians or anything else, okay? I think on the back of the foreign-instigated riots, he was convinced that there was an opening. The usual, it's a house of cards, kick in the door, this mantra that we've heard over and over again. And that has subsided, and now he's kind of left literally kind of holding the bag, because many Arab Gulf countries do not want an attack. Israel doesn't want an attack. So again, why, George?
Well, that's a very good question. And I tend to agree with you, Peter, that he really doesn't care that much about Iran. There's no real, if you go back into his trajectory, he's never really talked very much about Iran in the past. And, you know, he's actually shown that generally to be quite pragmatic and flexible in his foreign policy. Now, I agree that the national security strategy did talk about the United States withdrawing from the Middle East, but we've heard that so many times before, because, of course, the Middle East does look like, well, what the hell are we doing here? You know, why are we getting ourselves bogged down with all these, you know, little states, all their petty squabbles?
The United States and Iran should be allies, logically.
No, that's right. Exactly. So to answer your question, I mean, I do think that Israel is a key player here. And I tend to agree really with what you said the other day, which is that Netanyahu sees this as a golden opportunity to deal with the Iranian problem once and for all, because he's never going to get as favorable a president in the White House as Donald Trump. So, you know, Netanyahu, you know, he's got a calendar, he's looking and seeing, well, Trump obviously has got 3 years left, but it may be less because we don't know what kind of crises are down the road for Trump. So there may be just pressure on Trump coming from Israel that, hey, this is the time to strike. You know, it's vulnerable. You know, the place is teeming with hatreds.
But as long as Israel doesn't get involved.
That's right. So this may, that this is your historic opportunity. And I think that's tempting for him. But Trump is, of course, somebody who does like to walk away. When he doesn't get somebody, he walks away, and then there's a new crisis. All our attention are fixed on the new crisis. This is the new Trump problem.
You know, Mark, I think if we look at it like from 30,000 feet here, my impression is it's less and less about Iran than he saw an opportunity for a win. And if he can define it as a, if it's regime change or kidnapping the supreme leader, whatever, he just wants a win. The problem is that it doesn't really move the needle among American voters. That issue, maybe what's going on in Minnesota might, but, you know, Iran, that will be in the headlines for a few days. And then, as George said, the next crisis comes up. So he was maybe convinced it was an easy win here. Now it's not an easy win, and he doesn't know what to do.
There's no question that he felt emboldened by his perceived success in Venezuela. The New York Times tells us that the military has even presented him with the option of a commando raid in Iran. And I'm like, what do you think that's going to do? Because Iran is not Venezuela. Iran is a significant military power. I believe recent events, the Iranian attack, the CIA-Mossad insurgency, have shown that it has considerable support among genuine support among at least a substantial majority of the Iranian population. As for the U.S. voters, no one cares what they think. They don't vote on foreign policy, and it's you know, works regardless. But there are plenty of people around Donald Trump, including his big campaign donors, you know, not going to mention names, Adelson or anything like that, and people within his own administration who do very much want Iran. They see that as an even greater priority than China or Russia. And quite obviously, you know, they've got his ear at this particular moment, and they probably sold him on the success of Venezuela, and Netanyahu probably sold him on, oh, the regime is tottering as a result of the quote-unquote protests that Mossad and the CIA had nothing to do with. He's led into it. But ultimately, they're back in the exact same position they were. Unless they can get an extremely successful decapitation strike, and there's no guarantee that even that alone would topple the Iranian government, then they're right back that where they were June of 2025, and neither the U.S. nor Israel has the air defense intercenter stockpiles to fight a long-range strike war of attrition with an Iran that is just stacked with ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones capable of striking Israel and U.S. bases throughout the Middle East.
You know, George, Trump tweeted out, and you and I discussed it elsewhere, you know, it's time to make a deal. Well, that deal, it's not a deal, it's called surrender. And so, again, Trump boxes himself in because there is no room for negotiation unless you want to stop playing the game and you knock over your king. But we know from the 12-day war, the Iran is not only not interested in that, is that it has the capacity, as Marx pointed out, to defend itself. So Trump is giving a false option here. There is no negotiation going on. It's surrender.
No, that's right. And the accounts that were published in the New York Times as to what is Trump demanding, which is one, end enrichment, two, get rid of your ballistic missiles, and then three, abandon all of your proxies in the region. Well, that is essentially unconditional surrender. So that isn't going to happen. But what Trump could do, and he's done this before, he could just do a symbolic strike, you know, hit a few targets and then say, well, Iran has agreed to negotiate. We're going to have a meeting. And then we'll all say, yeah, but Iran was always willing to negotiate. But it doesn't really matter because, you know, however many times you can say, oh, Trump is lying, Trump is misleading, Trump is, you know, mischaracterizing it. It doesn't matter because we're on to the next crisis. So he could just do that, hit Iran, make a symbolic strike, and then say, well, and now on Saturday, Marco Rubio will be meeting with Iranian foreign minister, and we're going to get a fantastic deal done. And then we're over, and then we go on to the next thing. Look, he walked away from the Greenland. I mean, we were heading for this Greenland crisis. And we've already forgotten that whole Greenland crisis. It was only about 10 days ago. He walked away from it and said, oh, yeah, we're going to get a fantastic deal, even though we don't know what this deal is. So we could just be heading for something like this. Yeah, we're going to get a great deal with Iran. We're going to start negotiating in Oman, and that's it. And then we're on to the next thing.
I don't know, Mark. The Iran has made it very clear, and because they can have the same perception. This moment is the most advantageous for them. They've learned a lot from the 12-day war. They know a lot about Israeli defenses and American defenses defending Israel. They can have the same calculation. You know, the stars have all lined up. I mean, the American strike will hit them back really hard, including Israel. So I wouldn't, Trump's theatrics is not going to work out well here. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, the Iranian government has actually made it clear that any attack on Iran, unprovoked act of aggression by the Trump regime, will lead to a full-scale war with Iran. They will not pull their punches this time because they figure the Trump administration will just be back in another 6 months or a year. Yeah. So they're fully prepared. This time, they have turned to their Russian and Chinese allies in the BRICS groupings in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And it seems that they have acquired certainly a greater degree of help. I think they are better prepared for this, both militarily and mentally, than they were last June. And if Trump thinks he's going to pull some kind of PR spin and misdirect, drop some bombs, declare victory, and go home. I don't think the Iranians are going to let him get away with this bullshit.
All right, gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. All right, I'm going to kick it over to George right now. George, let's talk about self-harm. I guess that's what we need to call it. And the Europeans and their rampage to damage themselves. They have done enormous damage to their economy, to their financial credibility. I mean, plotting to steal another country's sovereign assets. They haven't achieved it yet, but it's not for lack of trying. And then a big rollout that, you know, by 2030, no Russian energy will be imported into the European Union. Well, you know, George, nobody is forcing the European Union to import anything. I mean, at least the Russians aren't. Okay. That's, you know, water off the back of a duck. The world likes fossil fuel and they'll buy Russian. Europeans, well, that's just, you know, that's your principal thing. But being principled really should be caring about your people. And it's in principally, they are not, the Europeans, caring about their own people, let alone their economic survival. So where do we go from this? I mean, they feel at least the leaders feel great about themselves. Nobody else does. George.
No, it's very interesting that the key to European economic success, particularly the economic success of Germany, had always been this cheap Russian energy.
Reliable.
And it was always reliable in the Soviet era, reliable in the post-Soviet era. And everybody always knew this. Now they have sabotaged this. And, they signed this agreement last week. No more pipeline gas, no more liquefied natural gas from Russia. And they were congratulating themselves, even though Hungary and Slovakia are now threatening to bring a lawsuit against them. I doubt whether it'll be successful. But now they're going to become entirely dependent on importing liquefied natural gas from the United States. This is something the United States always wanted. And the United States, and Trump particularly made that a condition of that trade deal that they signed last year, that you import a huge, huge amount of liquefied natural gas from us. And the national security strategy explicitly said, we're going to use our energy dominance in order to coerce the rest of the world. I mean, they pretty much said that's our foreign policy. So what the Europeans have now done is they've abandoned this mythical that they were dependent on Russia, even though Russia never used energy as a way of coercing anyone. So they've abandoned that for reliance on the United States, which has used energy to coerce others, and is openly promising, that's what we're going to do. We are going to use this. And this is after the last week's hysteria about Greenland. How are we being bullied by the United States in Greenland? They're attacking us, our sovereignty, our territorial integrity. The Americans are not respecting us. So, let's become completely dependent on them. Makes very little sense.
Okay, let me go over to Mark right now. Mark, one of the things I've never really been able to understand, I've obviously, as George has pointed out, the United States was never happy that the Europeans consumed so much cheap, reliable Russian energy. Now they have that market. They've captured it. It's very lucrative. They charge very high prices. The Europeans apparently are going to be willing to pay for it. But it impoverishes Europe. So how is a group of vassal states on the western end of Asia at all important to American foreign policy and strategy if they're just impoverished?
Right now, they are most useful for the United States as simply a ability to contain Russia for a period of time. The U.S. strategic prioritization that has been put out is supposedly now to deal with China first and then to deal with Russia afterwards. I think that is a tragic mistake. But all they need Europe to do is to hold the line against Russia. The Trump administration thinks that that can be done diplomatically. And then they want Europe to rebuild militarily to be able to deter Russia into the future. The problem is that the Europeans are not capable of that, and the Russians aren't interested in any diplomatic settlement of the Ukraine crisis except for on their own terms. And for the Europeans, they are so, the European political elite, and I'm not speaking of the European population here, the European political elite is so utterly consumed and obsessed by their hatred of Russia, by Russophobia it has roots going back centuries, but it has been, brought forward through a greater adoption of Western exceptionalism as a dominant ideology, even more, that they are willing to sacrifice their own economies, their own people's living standards, anything to spite Russia. And it's a terrible 1-2 combination, because not only are they paying at least double or more for American LNG and making themselves more dependent on the United States, but now that relatively cheap, reliable energy is going to Asia, which is making their economies even more competitive than it already was, and their economies were already more competitive than the Europeans. The Europeans' economies are doomed as a result of their own hatred of Russia.
Well, so, George, if their economies are doomed, ergo, their political system is equally doomed, okay? If you can't provide a modicum of responsibility and governance, this political system is going to collapse. And who knows what's going to come in its wake, George?
Yes, and the political systems are indeed very shaky, which is why I think it makes sense for them to mobilize their populations for some kind of a showdown with Russia, that this is the only way they can keep the whole European project going, they can keep all of the elites in power for years to come. Because that's ultimately, what would make sense for them is to go back to the status quo ante, which is cheap, reliable energy from Russia, and reputation, but George, they're not going back to that. So this is really...
The problem I have with that is that I think we've all long agreed that this is an elite project. I can't see you mobilizing French and Italian, Portuguese teenagers. Yeah, let's go to Ukraine and fight. I mean, I that's one of the things that's always been very missing. It's an elite project. It's not about security. It's not about prosperity. It's gotten, as Marcus pointed out, it's kind of like a psychosis. George.
It is a psychosis, but the remarkable thing is there hasn't been a really strong popular revolt against this policy. I mean, there's been AFD has quibbled about this, and but the AFD's criticism of the German government is mostly focused on the immigration issue. Yeah, I mean, they don't like the foreign policy, but that's not really the main thrust. The French right is divided on the issue of Russia and Ukraine. I mean, between Le Pen and Jordan Bardella. So then again, Nigel Farage, the populist in the UK, he's down, on the Russian policy. So it hasn't yet manifested itself. So, if you're a member of the elite, you may well think we can manage this this opposition. I mean, they did it in Italy. We thought, we've got Giorgio Meloni. Well, so,
Mark, you're agreeing.
Yeah, absolutely. The Europeans have a very tightly managed, quote-unquote, democratic system. They are confident that they can weather the storm. The first part is the media, right? The media never asks the question, never critically examines the government's foreign policy, because as the European Fourth Estate, they are ideologically committed to the anti-Russian project to the same level or greater than the political elites. So the question is never brought to the European population's attention the way it should be. Our living standards are going down because of our elite's obsession with geopolitical conflict with Russia. So, and on top of that, the center-right, center-left shuffle in most European countries, whether we're talking Germany or France or elsewhere, no matter how unpopular those parties are, the way their political systems are structured essentially gives the population no easy choice. If you choose Coke or Pepsi, both have the same foreign policy towards Russia. Doesn't make any difference.
Does that include conscription?
That is, I think, probably the $10 million question, or I guess $10 billion question.
Well, George, you live in Hungary.
I think it can be done as long as you provide decent financial incentives for anyone who joins up. First of all, young people, they're knocking about, being conscription, it's a lot of fun, you being outdoors doing, physical activity. But if you also tie that with a nice lump sum payment, for education, good job down the road, you can raise a decent enough size army in most European countries.
So, Mark, propaganda, Russophobia, and going into debt. That's the solution.
I think there's got to be one more. I don't think a financial incentive alone is going to be, they're not going to be able to recruit enough militaries. They need conscription, as the Kiev regime does, to fight Russia. And the only thing they really have there is some truly atrocious false flag. That is the only option they have for motivating their populations into hating Russia the way they do.
I don't think there's any other program on broadcast television that talks about or worries more about false flags than the three of us, okay? Because it's always the catalyst. It's always the way to move the needle is just to terrify people. And that's what democracy in the West has gotten down to. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules. We'll be right back.